Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Randeep Janda filling in for Drancer this week and on Monday as well. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Now joining us to talk a little NHL draft, maybe some Stanley Cup playoffs as well. From Sportsnet, he is Sam Cosentino. Sam, thanks for doing this. How are you?
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, doing great. Thanks. Pretty pumped about what we're seeing in these playoffs. There's always a lot of intrigue and never a day without a different and interesting storyline.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to start with the draft. And I know in your March rankings up at Sportsnet, you had Matthew Schaefer first overall. That seems to be consensus very much as he is holding down that top spot. Is that race over, or is there still something that could happen that could dislodge him from that first overall spot?
Well, it's going to be, I think, a tiny bit team dependent. So if you're looking at a team like Anaheim, for example, right? They move out a guy like Cam Fowler. They need to get their young defenseman playing. They're stocked with them. Maybe it's a situation where they go in a different direction with a forward like Michael Mesa, maybe a James Higgins. But I think in just about every scenario, and probably 95% of the scenarios, I think Schaefer is going to end up being that guy. I think it's so difficult to find a defenseman who's got all kinds of room to fill out. There's been some injury issues here in the past and obviously a lot of tragedy and adversity in his life, but he is such a wonderful young man that if you weren't sure about his ability to play the game by the time you meet him, I think you're looking at a world-class individual as well. So I see in just about every scenario that he ends up going first, unless it's a team that's just loaded with young D.
Well, you mentioned a couple of the options maybe for Mesa, but, when we start talking about Chicago and San Jose, like, which team do you think needs Matthew Schaefer right now?
Well, I think any team could use him, right? That's a premium position, and for me, he's a top-pairing guy. So, even an Anaheim could technically use him. But when I'm looking at a team like Chicago, there's so much thirst for getting someone to play with Bedard. You see Frank Mazar going there, and he did such an excellent job this year. He's got such a high ceiling. What a wonderful young player. But I think adding to the forward group in Chicago would work really well. I look at where San Jose Sharks are in defense. Getting a guy like Dickinson with what they already have. Mohamed Doolin is a guy I think really, really highly of. He's just kind of getting going here. So they could kind of go either way there. But I think a forward would also suit them well. But you're looking at Smith and Celebrini and Eklund. So yeah, I think in that situation where you're pretty content with what you have on both sides, maybe what you do is you look for the best available asset or the best available player. So most times that's what general managers are going to tell you. We're going to take the best available player. I don't believe that's always the case, and I believe it's not always the case more often than what you're hearing from the general manager. So a lot of really good players that are available. I think one thing I'd say about this draft class, though, is that of all the highly skilled forwards, a lot of them are of similar size. When I look at Cole Reshny out of Victoria, Ben Kindle out of Calgary, James Higgins, who's so highly thought of, all guys that are in that like 5'10", 5'11", 175 to 185 pound range, I think teams are going to be looking more at a little size. But then when you're looking at trying to draft size, yet you have a guy like a Ben Kindle who's such a dogged and determined player sitting there for you, it's hard to check every box, I guess, would be the best way to put it. So I think there's a ton of intrigue in this draft because of that.
Yeah, it's a great point because so often, Sam, we see the bigger prospects and the more athletic prospects with kind of that interesting physical makeup rise as we go along in the process. And, there's names that we've heard, obviously Schaefer at the top and Mesa, and you mentioned Hoggins, Martone, guys who we expect to go certainly right around that top five mark. Is there someone outside of that right now that you think, because maybe of those physical characteristics, could end up rising and challenging for a top five spot come draft day?
Well, for me, Caleb Dunoy has been that guy. He plays in Moncton, and he's been that guy all season long. So I think he checks in at like 6'1", probably 180, 283 pounds. But having met him on a couple of occasions, he's got big hands and he's got big feet. And for what that tells me is you're projecting a guy who's going to really grow into his body and maybe be a 6'3", 205-pound guy. Aside from that, in terms of just size alone, like, I love his game. This guy can play the game any way you want. If it gets physical, that's not a problem. If there's skill, not a problem. Leadership needed, good. You need a face-off one. You need a guy who's responsible in his own zone. He can do that. So I think I've been a lot higher on Dunoy than most prognosticators this year. I just have a feeling that I think he's going to be a – I don't know if he's going to be a superstar player, but I think he's going to be the type of player that every team needs to win, who can fit in like the 2C role, show some versatility, and do just about everything. So a lot of people probably don't have him in the top five. Dunoy would be that guy for me.
Right shot defensemen are always valued, but when they're 6'6" and they play in the Western Hockey League, you get a little bit more street cred. Radim Mertka, who plays for the Seattle Thunderbirds, like a physical presence, no doubt about that. He can score, but you know, what do you see in this player, and what's the projection with him?
So I thought it was a great move on his part to come over to North America and play. He was playing sporadically at home, and it didn't quite work out or showcase the best of his abilities. And when he got to Seattle, there was all kinds of opportunity awaiting him. And aside from the opportunity, there was a guy who could really kind of prove to be that he was worth all of the ice time that he expected to get at home. In Seattle, he was afforded all of that opportunity. And he came here. He came out guns a-blazing. He was putting up a point per game. And then as the year started to progress, we moved into the latter stages of the season. He really slowed down in that regard. And I think when looking at the transition in coming to North America and things kind of settling down away from the rink, there became that realization that, hey, you know what? This is maybe a little bit more difficult than I thought. So I think the world of this young man, I think it's very difficult to make that move in the middle of the season. He was able to do that transition successfully. And so I think very highly of him as well. And you know, a number of teams are really going to be appreciative of that size and that skating ability at that size.
So pending lottery results, and obviously the Canucks a major long shot to move up if they win the lottery from 15th, but pending lottery results, Canucks are going to have the 15th pick. We'll see if they actually end up making it. But, you know, teams always say best player available in the first round, right? Having said that, we can also look at the Canucks depth chart and see one of the major areas of need for this team is down the middle, is at center. So middle of the first round potential center prospects. Who's catching your eye there, Sam?
There's a guy by the name of Jack Nesbitt who was just named to Canada's under-18 team. He played with the Windsor Spitfires, and he's a guy that I am really, really high on. Again, probably a little bit higher than most. He's one of those guys who maybe in that Windsor lineup, because they have so many big forwards, he doesn't stick out like he should. But being one of the younger guys, he was able to kind of learn from what it's like to be a young player like a Liam Greentree, who was drafted in the first round by LA last year, and learn under that type of guy as to how to go about using your body and being most effective. So he's a guy too, doesn't mind the physical play at all, will be the aggressor on occasion. I like that. He can win draws for you. He's really good around the net. Hand-eye coordination is fantastic. A little bit like another former Windsor Spitfire player in Gabe Vilardi in that regard. I think there's probably some work to be done in terms of his puck protection and board play, but he's a pretty responsible guy as well, which you don't always see that at this age. So he's someone probably in the middle there that I would take a liking to and have a great appreciation for his game.
And just looking at this draft class broadly, Sam, you know, I know going ahead a year to 2026, obviously a ton of excitement about Gavin McKenna at the top of that draft and some of the other prospects that could be in the top five mix there. How do you look at this draft in the first round and then and judge its strength relative to some other recent years?
Well, I look to about pick 12, and then I see kind of scattershot, if you will. I think there's going to be a number of ways teams that are picking after 12 can go. And so that, for me, probably speaks to maybe not the highest quality depth in this year's draft. I think that's going to change next year. You know, obviously McKenna, you know, being the headliner there and what he's done already in the Western Hockey League is going to change the narrative of that draft instantly. But when I look at this draft class compared to some of the recent others, A, you don't have that rock star guy like a Bedard. I do think Schaefer is a wonderful player. I do think he's a top pairing guy. I don't know if he has that dynamic kind of ability as what Connor Bedard has. And so you don't have, hey, this is the Bedard draft. And then when I look beyond that, what I'm seeing is not that level of high-end depth. So I would be really happy to be picking inside of 12. After that, I'd be willing to move off of my first-round pick and try and find a team that's really excited about a guy who's not picked in that top 12 and maybe acquire an additional asset for a draft later down the road. But what I'm looking at with this group is I like it, but I don't think it's as quality as, let's say, the last 5 or 6 years in terms of the depth in the first round.
Well, we were talking a little bit about the Canucks' options down the middle of the ice and potentially that first round, but I do want to talk about the Canucks here and now. Atu Ratu, who you've been following for some years now, going back to his draft year in 2021 and before, at the end of the season, he showed something, whether it was in the faceoff circle, whether it was, you know, showing some consistency at the NHL level. What did you see from him this year in his cameo with the NHL Canucks? And, you know, does he have what it takes to take a starting job next year?
Yeah, he's a really interesting prospect for me. And if you go back to the start of his draft year, like basically the August, the July and August of his draft year, he was thought to be a top five guy. And then went and was playing in pro, and I think Brad Lambert was in and around there, and he didn't kind of measure up to even Lambert at that point. And you're like, well, what, you know, this doesn't give, because he's a bigger player. He's a guy who's got some pedigree, and it didn't quite work out the way everyone thought it would. He just kind of dropped like a stone to the, you know, the outside of the first round. So, you know, and the Islanders take a chance on him. And then, of course, you're switching teams. And I loved his game at the end of the year, guys. Like, I ended up doing a few of the Canucks games in studio, and I loved what he was bringing to the table. I had no idea he was going to be that good in the faceoff circle. I had no idea that he would play with a little bit of that physical edge that I saw. And, of course, I think the skill has always been there. It's just never been given the opportunity to be exposed. You know, when you're a young player and you come into the league and you go into your second team and you're having trouble finding your way, and I just think it's really difficult to be at your best because you're not given the opportunity. But you also really haven't earned that opportunity. So it's a really difficult spot to be in. The change of scenery thing allows you, or allowed him in this particular case, to get more opportunity. And I think he took full advantage of that opportunity. And I do believe there's a spot next year for him on the Canucks roster.
Sticking with Canucks prospects, obviously a lot of conversation right now about the status of Tom Vilander. And I think when his season with Boston University ended, a lot of us thought it would be pretty straightforward to get him signed. Obviously, it hasn't played out that way. And, you know, putting aside exactly what's going on there, it's fascinating because clearly there's a thought that he's ready to turn pro. There was a desire to turn pro. Now we hear, you know, he was in Sweden, played for the Swedish national team, could go back to school next year, could be in the AHL with Abbotsford. There's so many different options. Purely from a developmental standpoint, for him to take that kind of next step as a defender and hopefully an impact player down the road, what's the best near-term solution for Tom Vilander to continue developing as a player?
I'd say, honestly, probably another year in college. I think that would serve both him and the team well. To go back there and, you know, maybe change some of the narrative that we saw around him this year and go back to college and be a dominant player. He's a guy, man, this guy is loaded with confidence. And I do think that was a really big part of why he was drafted so high and why the Canucks felt so highly of him in his draft class, because he was just this kid who walked into the room. He had presence. He was loaded with confidence. He played a game that bent a bunch of different ways in terms of physicality, point producing. And if you think back to where he came from in that draft class, he really came from nowhere. You know, Sandin Pelikka was the guy that everyone was talking about, and it ended up being Vilander, who was the guy that ended up showing better than what everyone had projected. So I think when you're in that situation, you want to take that swagger and take that confidence and then apply it in college. And I just don't think he did that to the level that everyone expected. I think having a year of understanding what it's like to come to North America, play, be successful, and kind of get the feel for things, one more year of that, I think would bring back that swagger and confidence that made him such a high pick in the first place.
Sam, just before we let you go, I just kind of want to ask you a big picture question about the CHL and I guess junior hockey more broadly here in Canada. And, you know, we all know the NCAA rules have changed, which is going to make it a lot easier for players to go from the CHL to play NCAA hockey in the United States. I don't know that anybody really knows how that's all going to play out. What's the sense you're getting from talking to people around the CHL about what the future looks like and what the status, the new status quo might end up looking like for junior hockey in Canada?
I think we're going to need 5 years to really kind of figure out what this thing is going to do. Now, I got to tell you, like, I've heard already of some players that are, you know, being rumored to leave probably earlier than you would expect. And so that is going to be a very interesting element to all this. And I say 5 years for a couple of reasons, right? Like, players who are signed, that's a no-fly zone, right? That's a no-go zone right now. I wonder if somehow that changes when the new CBA is written. Not so much from, like, you know, if the NCAA obviously would have to agree to that. But I just wonder if when everyone gets together and the new CBA is written, how this thing is going to play out in terms of the draft signing period. You know, is it going to be a situation for the NCAA? Are they going to be challenged? Hey, if I'm signed, why can't I go play in college? And you start to see some legal challenges in that regard. So that's one area for me. The next is the CBA. What happens? The signing period. Okay, the next thing after that is, what's going to happen with the NIL money? Right, the NIL money would be the big drawing card for players to go earlier than expected from the CHL to the NCAA. Currently, Canadian-born players, because they're not there on a work visa and would only be there on a student visa, would only be eligible for passive income, as I understand it. What does that mean? Basically, jersey sales. Nothing where you can be in a commercial or in any kind of video or post or anything like that. And so in hockey, there's really just not a lot of that available right now. I think the agents need time to figure out the loopholes around that. And I think that's going to be a period of time, maybe not as long as 5 years, but I think 3 years. And then I also think, like, what's it going to be like in terms of player agreements that players sign with their CHL teams? What do those things look like? I already hear there's changes afoot in that regard. I just think that there's so many questions that we're not even in the first off season yet, that by the time we get 5 years from now, we're going to have a true sense of what it means. If it were me and it were my kid, I would say, go get all the miles you can in the Canadian Hockey League. Let's try and bend the Canadian Hockey League to offer more spots to 16-year-olds. Let's understand, as the CHL, we need to get younger. And then let's try and get our players to stay there for 3 to 4 years. After that period, let them go experience more physical growth, a weekend schedule, more off-ice kind of stuff, and go experience 2 or 3 years of college, and then you're ready to play pro, where you might be able to bypass the American Hockey League. So that's the path I would want my son to be on. I don't know, like, you know, everyone wants to get there the fastest, be the best, be against the Joneses, all that sort of thing. So that's going to impact what I think the route should be. But I truly think we're going to need 5 years to get this thing sorted out.
It's going to be fascinating to watch how it all unfolds. I mean, you're right. There's going to be so many different twists and turns here and uncertainty as everyone figures out exactly what it's going to look like. Great insight, Sam. Really appreciate it. And enjoy the Stanley Cup playoffs again tonight.
Okay, thanks, guys. Take care.
That is Sam Cosentino from Sportsnet, covering the NHL and the NHL draft as well. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And lots of thoughts came in about our Rick Tocchet conversation in the first segment and in the whiteboard specifically. And Greg Wyshynski from ESPN reporting that at least one source says Tocchet could be seeking as much as $5 million annually over a five-year term on his next contract. That is a very big ticket relative to NHL coaching salaries. And JB texts in, 5x5 for a non-Stanley Cup winning coach. Man, that's a tough pill. And I love Tocchet and defended him all year when fans complained about him. Rafe says $5 million is his way to kick the door open to leave. drops an expletive and then says, we are never getting ahead. That's from Rafe. It's a big number. There's no doubt about it that it is a big number. It does feel almost a little bit like Rick Tocchet consciously trying to reset the coaches market. It's also just a reflection of his leverage. Like, teams are waiting. Teams are waiting on to see what Tocchet does before they make a move. When you're in that position, you've got a lot of power, and you know, full credit to Rick Tocchet for recognizing it and trying to wield the hammer.
Yeah, there's a couple of ways you can look at this, right? The timing works out that Tocchet has that leverage. He won the Jack Adams list last year. If the Canucks didn't want the situation where the option kicked in, you negotiate right after that Jack Adams and say, hey, let's give you a contract. And maybe it's not to the same degree at, you know, the $5 million or whatever that number is. But here's the thing. We've all heard it. We've heard that this was a difficult season. His players saying he probably did a better job coaching this year than he did last year, like with all the stuff he had to deal with. Management acknowledging that as well. Of course, internally, you're going to feel that too.
Yep.
So this is the danger of if you let it kind of, and this could have been a tangible Rick Tocchet decision as well. I don't want to negotiate until I want to, right? Like he said it numerous times where even last training camp, it was, I want to deal with it at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
You pick your leverage, and for Vancouver, the downside here is that even though they had a down year, the coach is still on the way up in this league. Like, he is very well respected, not only amongst management teams, coaches and players respect Rick Tocchet for the way he played the game and the way he coaches, his communication style. And now, a lot of this, to me, has to do with resetting the coaching market.
Yeah.
You know, we talked a few years back, and just like Rick Tocchet may be trying to get his value, you know, Rod Brind'Amour a few years didn't want to go to the market and said, all right, if I'm being grinded a little bit by the Carolina Hurricanes, that's all right.
He said, whatever, I've got a good situation here, I'm going
to
stay.
I'll take less than market value.
Yeah.
And respect to him for doing that, but the opposite can be true too, Jamie, and that's what makes this a tricky situation. We got six teams potentially linked to you or interested in you. I hear a cash register. Absolutely, the money's going to go up.
And Brendan and Burnaby says, if Quinn Hughes wants Rick Tocchet, you pay the man, no debate. That's probably what Rick Tocchet is thinking as well, right? Like, that's a huge piece of his leverage. We all know how important the Quinn Hughes situation is, and we know how much Quinn Hughes likes Rick Tocchet. That just adds to the leverage.
For sure it does. And I think it also factors into Rick Tocchet's decision. Does he have a better understanding of where Quinn Hughes will be in a couple of years? Also, the other thing is, you know, I think for Rick Tocchet, why would you not use that leverage that you've probably worked your entire career to get? We talk about players in UFA status. Coaches, when you're at the top 5-10 range, that's leverage that you've built. It's not like somebody gifted it to you. And the one difference here is cap versus non-cap spending.
Yep.
Right? Like, it's not my money, so obviously I can say, hey, if the guy wants to get paid, go for it. But there is a difference here. Cap versus non-cap spending.
It's also, if you're comfortable paying him $4 million and he's going for $5 million, can you settle at $4.5 million or something like that, right? And then, okay, $500,000, that's a lot of money to me and you. In the grand scheme of running an NHL team, it's not that much. And if you think a coach is going to meaningfully improve your chances of making the playoffs, which by all accounts, Canucks management does think about Rick Tocchet, well, that's a great investment. That's an incredible return on investment then at that point, right? So, like, I get it. Everything's a negotiation. You don't want to just roll over and capitulate to what Tocchet is demanding. But there's a lot of potential rewards to going a little farther and meeting his demands as well.
And the other thing I would say, though, is, of course, if you're looking at Quinn Hughes' future and you think you might have a rebuild in a couple of years, if it goes the other way, yeah, you're probably thinking about that term. You're probably thinking that dollar value and term and saying, hey, if this is something that doesn't work out and the coaches, we're going to have to make a change. Those ghosts of the past of paying three coaches at one time, those are a very real thing for teams, right? It feels like maybe this organization's been a little scarred by that.
Well, that's one of the ways you get security by a coach, right? Your salary going up makes teams more reluctant to fire you. All right, we can continue this conversation throughout the show. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Up next, open segment, we'll turn our attention again to potential targets and one potential target in specifically that Randeep is going to pitch us to help solve the Canucks' top six center issues going in to next season. We'll do that next here on Canucks Talk. Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Randeep Janda. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, footwear, and orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We'll chat with Pete Blackburn about the Stanley Cup playoffs. He's the host of the What Chaos podcast. That's coming up at 1:30. But we started doing something on the show yesterday, and we all know the Canucks, they need help. They need help up front. Maybe three players, according to Jim Rutherford earlier this week. Down the middle especially, but I think you could say really just in general, they need high-end talent, or at least talent with the potential to be high-end up front going forward, and that's going to be the major focus of the summer. Yesterday, I had a turn to pitch a specific player to you, to the listeners, to the Canucks. Hey, go out and at least kick tires on this guy. And again, universal acclaim for my idea of bringing Trevor Zegras, the Trevor Zegras Rick Tocchet marriage that everyone's been clamoring for.
Except probably Rick Tocchet.
Maybe that's the holdup. They're trying to convince Rick Tocchet that Trevor Zegras is a good idea.
Like, we got this idea.
Just listen.
We were listening to radio yesterday, and this former attorney at law, Jamie Dodd, made a great point.
He made a great case about this player and why it makes so much sense. So anyways, that was my pitch yesterday. Now it's Randeep's turn to solve all of the Canucks' problems up front with one player. Randeep.
All right. Tell me how this sounds.
Okay.
24 years old.
All right. I like it.
6'1".
Okay.
Left shot center, 200 pounds.
Okay. Left shot. Not ideal. You'd love that right shot, but all right. Sure.
Not bad, right?
Not bad.
The profile, like, you know, a bigger player, play down the middle, play some heavy style of hockey. That player's name is Barrett Hayton.
Okay.
And going back to 2018, he was taken two picks before Quinn Hughes.
He must be way better than Quinn Hughes. Incredible.
Not necessarily. That pick was ripped, but Hayden had to live with that for a while, and he's rounded into form a little bit. He's started to take steps to achieve that top six status, and he's really grown his two-way game. So for me, you know, you have a center that is able to hit the 20-goal mark. He did that this year. He's 55% in the faceoff circle, which is something that this team needs, especially without having JT Miller. He can play through the tough matchups. He played on the top line and the top six at the very least for Utah last year, so he's able to take those toughs. Better at neutral zone play. We've seen him attacking with speed in Utah this year, and to me, like, those areas are very important for the Vancouver Canucks moving forward as well. We've heard them talk about it, but here's the thing. He's a meat and potato center as well. This team needs size. They need some grit, and Barrett Hayton gets to the middle of the ice. He doesn't live outside in the perimeter. He creates room in the middle of the ice for his line mates, scoring wingers. Jonathan Lekkomäki in the top six? Well, guess what? You're going to need somebody to eat space in the middle and create havoc in the middle. Hayden can play that style, and that's why I like this player. 58% goal expectancy when he was on the ice with the top line in Utah. So any line he was playing on with, they were above 55% of expected goals. So there is an effect there of when he's on the ice, Utah was a better team. So is he the sexy option of, you know, a Trevor Zegras? Look at what he was able to do over 75 games. He was the runner-up in the Calder. Yep. Not necessarily, but he hasn't had a true breakout season yet. He's a 45-point player, and he's been kind of up and down in the second and third line in Utah. I think if you give him steady matchups, if you give him steady skilled players in a top six role, this is a player that you could buy low relatively at a 40-point pace, who could give you 60 points over the number of years. Maybe, remember, he's 24 years of age. So that's why I look at Barrett Hayton to say, he's not going to get you the headlines, but can he eat matchups? Can he give you scoring? And can he take a leap? That's my pitch for Barrett Hayton.
So I like the name. I like Barrett Hayton. Let's work through the theory here. Because, like, I think this is a sweet spot of one of the things where you're finding a guy who you think has upside to grow, right? Who has not hit his full potential yet. And obviously the draft pedigree is there for Barrett Hayton. First time scoring 20 goals last year. One of the interesting things about his season, he had 7 power play goals last year. He had 7 in his entire career coming into this season, right? So found at least a little bit of a role in some production on the power play for the first time in his career with Utah, of course, Arizona before that. Because you got to try to build the case. Like, okay, what's the case for this player taking another step offensively? And I think of Bo Horvat. You know, when he found that niche on the power play, shooting from the bumper, that's one of the things that really caused his goal scoring to spike, and now he's a multiple-time 30-goal scorer. Bo Horvat was incredible at that, so I'm not saying that's what Hayton's going to do, but is that an element he can develop to take him from, you know, 40-45-point guy to 55-60-65-point guy? Because that's probably where you want, you know, you're not bringing in Barrett Hayton expecting him to be your number one center.
No.
You're bringing him in to be the defensive face-off matchup guy behind probably Elias Pettersson, who can also chip in offensively.
He's going to be a 200-foot player that hopefully can give you 50, 60 points if you can take that leap. Now, going from 45 to 60 is still 15 points.
It's tough.
To your point, are you able to get a little bit more from the power play? Are you able to have more of an attack mentality? And that's something that he's worked on the last 2 years to say, I want the puck on my stick. Mm-hmm. I need to create more. And we've kind of seen that in Utah. Now, the question here is, what's the incentive for Utah?
So that's the stumbling block for me. Well, I guess there's two. One is that I like Barrett Hayton as a player, and I can see the fit as a second-line center potentially, or a guy you hope can grow into a second-line center. You use the phrase meat and potatoes. The Canucks have meat and potatoes.
Yeah, but they don't
They need flash. They need the sizzle. They need the, not just like meat, they need like the Wagyu steak. That's what they need.
How many Wagyu steaks are available in the NHL trade market right now?
I'm just saying, it's hard. Like, you got to take that swing. And Barrett Hayton, I like him as a player. I think he works more as, if you're talking three, is he like the second guy you bring in, right?
Yes.
So maybe you get some star power on the wing and you bring Barrett Hayton in to solidify your center position.
But let me put it this way. If they go through free agency and address the winger aspect of that in free agency, if the pitch for Nick Ehlers is coming, or a similar player that's a puck carrier, that's got a little bit more flash, can probably hit you in transition a little bit more, you know, that would probably be a marquee acquisition. Mm-hmm. To me, Barrett Hayton is the number two acquisition.
Sure.
Where meat and potatoes, yes, the Canucks have those players, but they don't have guys with skill that apply both that. They don't have guys with that size in that top six. He addresses that, which the Vancouver Canucks lack that right now. Like, who are the guys that have the most tenacity in their top six?
Sure.
Nils Höglander?
It's an area of need, but I just don't think you can prioritize it over skill when you're talking about your additions to the top six. Like, ideally, you'd like to find the total package. As
sure.
you said, that's hard to do.
You got to make a couple of moves here, though, right?
Yes.
Like, the center position going to address everything? Kind of like the Zegras conversation yesterday. He may address something. He may lack a lot of other things.
Uh-huh,
I think there is no perfect acquisition, because if that perfect acquisition was out there at the center position, the team's not trading him. And Barrett Hayton, like, it's not going to be cheap to get him out of there, right? He's still 24 years old. He's trended in the right direction, even though he hasn't had a breakout season. So you're still probably looking at a first-round pick.
That's one of the big stumbling blocks here, right, is Utah obviously took a step this year. We don't need to go into Drance's thoughts on them. We all know. We all heard that.
Waxing
but they're
poetically.
They're trying to make the playoffs next year, right?
Sure.
And they have this group of young forwards, a lot of whom really found success. And all of the reasons we're laying out here for Barrett Hayton, you know, still only 24, maybe some untapped offensive upside, but also does a lot of the other things really well. Doesn't he kind of sound like the perfect complement to Logan Cooley, Clayton Keller, Dylan Gunther on that team going forward? So you always come back to, okay, well, what's the incentive for a team that, again, in a new market, is probably not playing the long game, like, to an extent, but they want to get better as well, right? So does the 15th pick do it? Is that value so good that they feel like, you know what, we got to do that? Or would you need to throw in even more?
I guess
if you're looking at Barrett Hayton.
I guess the question with Utah is, yes, they're playing a long game, but how long of a game, right?
No, I think they're a little bit long game, but they want to be good next year.
Exactly. Yeah. So you've got, let's go through some of the centers. They got Logan Cooley, who's their first-line center as of right now.
Yep.
Didn't start the season that way, went that way. Then you have Barrett Hayton, who is the second-line center, effectively. Nick Schmaltz, right-shot center, playing predominantly on the wing. You have Alex Kerfoot, and then you've got your bottom six centers, basically Kevin Stenlin and Jack McBain.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have centers there, but they're popping them out to the wing a little bit here.
Yep.
So I guess the biggest question with Barrett Hayton is, in 2 years, he's paid as an RFA.
Yeah, so he's got one more year left on his deal at, like, 2.65.
Which is a fantastic deal. And
then he's an RFA.
And for an acquiring team, that's going to be a part of the reason you're paying a lot, because he's making great money. But are you in a situation where you're saying, hey, you're going to have to pay some of these guys. You're going to have to pay Logan Cooley. You're going to have to pay all these players that are coming up. Dylan Gunther, of course, is making his money. Are you able to pry away a center because you've got all these other players still on that roster? And to Ryan Smith in Utah, do they want to go big game hunting?
Yeah.
Is sacrificing a player like Hayden
to get
a bigger
assets.
Fish?
Yeah.
To get a bigger fish, potentially.
You bring up an interesting name, though, because you run through it, and they actually are set up pretty well, certainly for next season at the center position, right? Even if it's not star players, you know, like Kevin Stenland, reliable player. Kerfoot, you know what you're going to get from him. And then, obviously, Cooley at the top. Jack McBain is an interesting one. Now, this is very much not the big fish acquisition, but this is an RFA. And we were talking yesterday about looking at the Washington Capitals, and one of the things that went right for them was the Alexi Protas glow up. And McBain, not quite as big, but, you know, 6'4", has shown some flashes, 13 goals this year in very much third line minutes, and he's an RFA. And I wonder if you're looking at it, and if you're Arizona, do you want to commit to both McBain and Hayton? Do you want to do that? Or, as you say, do you want to move some things around a little bit? Like McBain, again, you probably can't pencil him in as a number two center, but is that, if that was a guy who's available and you can at least take a flyer and say, okay, the physical tools are there, but if this guy puts it all together, all of a sudden we could have a bit of that unicorn element. You talk about the need for the grit, the size, the intensity, all of that stuff up front. Like 6'4" center with maybe some room to grow offensively, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, as a profile, 6'4", like he's got some greasy elements to his game too. He's always going for a somewhat questionable hit anytime you watch Utah play. Like he's got that element where, call it the Nick Cousins factor, call it whoever it may be. Here's the problem I see with Jack McBain. Does he really move the meter enough outside of physicality?
No, he's maybe like...
he's like a 30-point player,
right? The third or fourth guy you're bringing in.
Yes.
And you're hoping, again, that there's a upside there that he's going to unlock here.
If you're saying Atu Ratu is not ready for the NHL, McBain's a player that you bring in,
sure,
and say, behind Teddy Bluger or in front of Teddy Bluger, that's your center option. You're going to be a nasty piece of business to play against. And you bring some speed. You bring some size. Is he the more realistic option? I certainly think so. Like, the age is comparable. He's 25 versus Barrett Hayton's 24. But if you've got an abundance of centers who are popping out to the wing right now, maybe more realistic. But from a home run swing perspective, then you've got your... it doesn't move the meter as much, mm-hmm, for me. Like, in the playoffs, having Dakota Joshua on the one line and Jack McBain on the other, that would be a pain in the rear end on the forecheck.
Yeah.
They're both going.
Yeah, that's an interesting third line.
Right? I don't know.
Because we're talking top six centers, but you got to think about your whole depth chart.
Yeah. I like the profile. I still think you need somebody that can play the matchup role in that top six.
Yes,
and that's where Hayden kind of feels like the right type of player. Maybe not the home run swing for a lot of folks. But then, once again, Jamie, we go back to, who's that top six option, right? Like, who is that? Who's that running mate to Elias Pettersson? We don't even know if Elias is going to be back next year.
No.
Let's be honest.
We sure don't.
But who is that home run swing? Oh, Jim Rutherford did say it's going to be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that's the issue with Hayton for me, is it feels like the acquisition cost would be more expensive than the upside, right? To pry him loose, are you paying so much but not getting the ceiling that you necessarily need? That's my concern. I like him as a player.
Yeah,
it's an interesting pitch. Is the fit there in terms of what it's going to take to get a deal done?
The question is, do you bank on him having that ceiling where you're essentially saying we're buying here a little lower, but he can be that player? And that's the risk. That's the element of risk here.
Mike, the urologist from Brockville, says, underwhelming sales job, Randeep. Hayton versus Zegras. Hayton definitely lower ceiling, higher floor. I don't think he has the upside to make this team a contender, though.
Well,
it's part of a move. It's part of a series of
moves. It's not the home run swing of an offseason, but here's the thing, though. With Zegras, I feel like, yes, the price of acquisition is lower, but it's still like...
oh, the uncertainty
the
is
uncertainty
massive.
Is
massive, of course.
Barrett Hayton's not going to get scratched.
No.
Trevor Zegras... there's a good
probably going to get scratched.
So, yeah, you kind of get what you pay for, right? Like, the Edmonton Oilers can get criticized for their goaltending stinks. Yeah, you're paying a combined $3.6
million. Yeah.
You get what you pay for.
This text comes in. Why could Pugh Suter not fill the same role as Hayden? Well, again, faceoffs is a big one, right? Pugh Suter,
age,
not strong in the dot, and the physical tools. And that matters. And look, big fan of Pugh Suter, and I think he can contribute to a lot of winning teams. but I don't know if it's as your second line center, right? Like, ideally, you want to be able to use Pugh Suter as that wild card, as that super utility guy. You can move around the lineup, you know, help you on the penalty kill, play on the wing, all those sorts of things. But he's not going to be, I mean, we saw it down the stretch, he's not going to be your answer as a matchup guy against other teams' best players, especially in the playoffs, right? When the physicality and the athletic profile matters even more, Barrett Hayton has a chance to be that.
Well, here's also the thing, the floor versus ceiling argument. With Pugh Suter, 46 points this season, heck of a year. But I think it's fair to assume that this could be his ceiling, right? Like, you get
career
paid,
year. Yep.
You might be pushing $5 million per season, and his age is 28 years of age. He's going to be, in a couple of weeks, you're just under a month, he's going to be 29, where the guy that I'm proposing is 24 years of age. Like, sure, in order to acquire those players, you're going to have to pay because you have control. You have him before the prime years of his career, and you're comparing Suter's potential ceiling with Hayden's potential, like, near his floor. I think that is something, you know, the skill assessment and where they are in their career matters as well.
And really, again, that physical profile does really matter when you're talking about someone who can pay or play those tough minutes against guys in the playoffs. You need to have that element unless you're just phenomenal on a different level defensively and the way you think the game. And Suter's great at that, but it's still not enough to make you feel good about using him in those matchup roles in big games, hopefully in the future. This text comes in, Raph in the sewer. Jamie and Randeep, I don't want this team to be trying to raise the floor for our team. We need to raise the ceiling much more urgently. Swing for McTavish or Paterka, he says. No, two very interesting names. I mean, McTavish.
I love the Paterka one. I've been saying that for a couple weeks.
I don't know how you're getting McTavish. Like, I just don't know.
I don't see it
how you're doing that.
I think earlier this year, when there was maybe doubts of him actually playing the middle of the ice and he was struggling offensively, there was rumblings of what's his future. Then he absolutely torched it and was in a place of confidence with the team again. I don't see that happening. JJ Paterka, and we talked about this yesterday.
Now, not a center. He's a winger.
He's a winger.
Fascinating player. Like, that would be a great addition to the Canucks.
So a part of this exercise also is we're pitching players that you might not have thought of.
Mm-hmm.
JJ Paterka, I'm not going to lie, over the last 2 weeks, I've thought of a lot, right? And this is a player that I think would be, you know, in a sporting sense, of course. but yeah, this is a guy that we've talked about in the booth. We've talked about a fair bit. Like, he's exactly what you want for the Vancouver Canucks right now. The question I have is, once again, what is Buffalo doing if he's on the market again?
Well, Buffalo, there were
60-point player, right?
There were rumors that he was out there at the trade deadline.
Which is wild.
I don't, like, Buffalo is just such a weird wild card. Now, would they look at it, if you called them up and were like, hey, JJ Paterka, would they say, okay, like, we'll build a package for Elias Pettersson, right? Would that be the response, or would it be Volander? Like, they have a lot of defensemen. Who knows how happy they are in any of them? It's really hard to accurately suss out what Buffalo wants to do at any given moment. You know what I mean? So maybe he's available. It would be strange to me if he was, and I know people have highlighted him as a potential RFA option or offer sheet option. I'm down to explore that if you reacquire your third round pick. Like, that interests me.
Yeah, but Buffalo's got, they might have some money to play with the Caps.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
Right? 68 points last year. So here's the issue. I like Paterka as a player, but if you're going all in on that trade, and Jim Rutherford has mentioned that free agency is not how you're going to hit the center position, are you making two deals with premium assets going out of Vancouver for a center and a winger? I feel like if you're going to do a home run swing, you can probably only make one of those trades.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to pull a trade for a near 70-point player, which is not cheap in the NHL, I don't know where you're going to get the center from then.
Yeah.
Like, how do you make both of those
Trevor
deals?
Trevor Zegras.
Barrett Hayton.
It all comes back to that.
And that's why we're doing this, folks.
That's why we're talking about Trevor Zegras so much here. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This one comes in. We need a Matthew Knies. Good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck. That would be great. Good luck.
Top
Good luck
four power forward in the NHL.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they would make John Tavares play on a league minimum if anybody tried to offer sheet Matthew Knies. And guess what, Matt? John Tavares would probably agree to that league minimum.
He'd be like,
okay. Yeah, I want to stay home in my pajamas. Yeah, my Leafs pajamas.
And I want us to keep Matthew Knies here so I can play with him as well. Somebody else texts in, what about Morgan Geeky out of Boston? He had a monster year for the Boston Bruins. that's an interesting team in flux, right? Because who knows where they're going. Morgan Geekie's an RFA. Is there a desire for them to pay him coming off of a 33-goal season, a career-high season for the Boston Bruins? That's an interesting name, to be perfectly honest. Now, you have to be comfortable locking in and paying him, and what's that going to look like for a 26-year-old, 6'3" guy who just scored 33 goals playing down the middle? That could be pricey, but if Boston's not interested, if they're going in different directions, I actually like that shout from on Morgan Geekie.
Yeah, that one I didn't consider at all because, you know, it's a player that on Boston, you're not considering any players from Boston right now unless their name is like David Pastrnak. But Morgan Geekie, the danger with that one is it's kind of getting ahead of it or saying, hey, he had a great year.
It's almost the opposite where we talk so much about buy low on somebody. Yes. You're buying high on Morgan Geekie.
Or like the player is young enough where you're saying, okay, they might have had a good year, but is there more to give here? With Morgan Geekie, I'm not sure. I, you know, 33 goals is a heck of a season.
Yeah.
And if,
but are you getting more than that?
Yeah.
And, or is he even staying at that level?
Yeah.
That's the question.
And that's a tricky thing where you're just saying, okay. And the other thing, Jamie, it was on a losing team. Sometimes you pick up points in garbage time.
Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to be on the power play. Somebody's going to be playing those minutes. Yeah.
For the same reasons that, you know, we're skeptical maybe of Pew Suter's output near the end of the season when he was putting up a lot of points, like 5 million, you'd be wary. I think there's other players in other markets you have to say, okay, you know, there's a god-awful team in Boston. You put up points. What does that mean?
It is Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. We will wrap up the week next. We'll talk to Pete Blackburn about the Stanley Cup playoffs here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Randeep Janda live from the Kintec Studio. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. And Pete Blackburn is going to join us in just a second here. He's the host of the What Chaos podcast. And Randeep, justice has been served. The dastardly Ottawa Senators and Nick Cousins, they have been forced to pay for their crimes last night in Ottawa against the Leafs. $25,000 fine to the Ottawa Senators for unsportsmanlike conduct during warmups prior to Game 3. $2,000 and $83.33 Nick Cousins fined for his unsportsmanlike conduct.
And that is the maximum allowance for Nick Cousins, according to the collective bargaining agreement. But for anybody out there that ever wants to shoot a puck during the pregame warmups, there you go. Michael Anlauer, you now know, $25,000 coming out of your pocket.
It's going to cost you $2,000 and your owner $25,000. Now joining us, he is, as I said, the host of the What Chaos podcast. He is Pete Blackburn. Pete, how's it going?
Good. How are you guys?
We're doing well. I mean, is this sufficient punishment for the absolute monstrosity that the Ottawa Senators and Nick Cousins allowed to unfold last night?
What are we even doing here? This is ridiculous. It's unbelievable. We've seen like four players lose teeth because they took a stick right in the grill and get cross-checked in the face with no punishment. But Nick Cousins lobs a little puck at a former teammate, and here we are. It requires a full-blown investigation from Gary and the crew.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's puzzling, but whatever. It's done and dusted now and over with. But I guess, I mean, could this be the rallying cry to spur the big historic 3-0 comeback for the Ottawa Senators?
Listen, if that's the rallying cry that this series required, I think we can all dub the Battle of Ontario a massive disappointment.
Yeah.
Like, if that's what sets it off, come on. No, I wouldn't imagine. I also wouldn't imagine that, like, the Senators should need any more reason to feel like they need motivation to push back in this series. I don't know. You really would have liked to see them get one of the past two, right, where they went into overtime and, you know, you got an unlikely hero from from Toronto. I really thought that the game two stung because it did feel like a massive pushback from Ottawa throughout the course of that 60 minutes. And then you have just an atrocious play by Drake Batherson on both ends of the ice to give the game away. Just felt like that was one that they kind of needed.
Okay, so looking at this series, there's kind of two narratives that are going on right now. One is Ottawa maybe trying to mature and, you know, failing in those key moments. The Drake Batherson one, of course, is key there. The other one is that the Leafs, they finally figured it out. Craig Berube hockey is very mature hockey. This team doesn't get rattled. Which one do you believe more?
I think there's an element of truth in both, but I also think that, like, you can like what you've seen from the Leafs so far, but at the end of the day, like, and there's reason to like what you've seen, right? Because it's different. It fits a different mold than, like, the Leafs teams that have flamed out in the past. But also, like, if you consider Ottawa's gotten pretty bad goaltending from Linus Ullmark, with the exception of last night. Like, I thought last night he was pretty good. Fairly bad goaltending, some really strong defensive breakdowns, and they cannot defend on the penalty kill whatsoever. And still, the margins have been pretty thin in this series, like two games that required overtime. If Ottawa plays slightly better, this series could look a lot different. And I think that, like, if you can get between the heads of the Maple Leafs, especially, like, they always say the fourth win is the hardest. If you can get between the ears and give yourselves a little bit of momentum as the Senators, like, this series may not be over.
That would be great, because as you said, it's been a massive disappointment so far. Now, one of the other really interesting results from last night in a series that is shaping up not to be a big disappointment, Minnesota taking the 2-1 lead over Vegas, and it's really been Kirill Kaprizov and, of course, Matt Boldy as well doing a number on Vegas so far. Were we all guilty of maybe forgetting just how good a fully healthy Minnesota looked like earlier in the season?
I'm definitely guilty of that, but I will also say, like, there was plenty of reason to doubt them, not only because, like, the first 25 games of the season or whatever, very different from playoff hockey, but also because, you know, this is a team that has a core that has not experienced a whole lot of playoff experience or success, and they're under a first-year head coach, and they've been banged up basically all season long and have really weird things going around their medical staff that it extended even into Four Nations and all that kind of stuff around them. So there was reason to doubt them, but also it's easy to remember now that you see them on the ice and that they look healthy, that this was a really good team at the beginning of the year. They're also, it's even more impressive when you consider they're going up against Vegas, who have been like a really steady presence all season long. They do have the Stanley Cup experience. They do have the pedigree. They do have the coach who's been around the block and is pretty well respected. So, like, this is a really shocking development in my mind that Minnesota is not only not boring, but they're actually good and in the playoffs. Like, that's crazy to me.
Yeah, and they're also, like, that top line is absolutely, you know, beating the brakes off of Vegas's top line right now, where Jack Eichel, Mark Stone, Ivan Barbashev haven't gotten anything 5-on-5 against Minnesota. I guess the question I have is, like, we talked about this yesterday on the show, is Jack Eichel going to show up here 5-on-5? And the answer thus far is no. Is that more him, or is that just simply Kaprizov's line just taking over?
I would say it's Kaprizov's line, and also just, like, I think that Minnesota is beating Vegas at its own game. And you see some of that too earlier in the series. Shea Theodore made a couple of really out of character mistakes under pressure. And I just think that's a credit to Minnesota in the way that they play, like the aggressiveness that they came into the series with. They were not scared. They were not sort of cowering in the shadow of Vegas, a team that was, like, seemingly much better on paper than them. Minnesota's been hunting pucks and playing really, really hard this entire series. And it has put Vegas in a position where I think they're kind of having a mirror held up to them, and they don't know how to respond at this point.
Yeah, and with Kaprizov specifically, I mean, he was going to be in the Hart Trophy conversation before his injuries with what he was doing early in the season and what Minnesota was doing. And everyone knows he's a phenomenal player, but it does feel like this has a chance for him to break into that conversation of, okay, maybe right behind McDavid and MacKinnon, who are those next, and throw Dreisaitl in there after those guys, who are the best players, the best forwards in the NHL. And I think, you know, typically we would say Kucherov, right, and probably Auston Matthews. But with what Kaprizov is doing and doing it on the stage of the Stanley Cup playoffs, I feel like he has a chance to be the kind of next guy who enters that conversation.
Definitely, and I would put Boldy in that group as well. Like, obviously, Kaprizov is the leader and the driver of that team, but I had the question floated to me last night is, you know, where do Kaprizov and Boldy rank as a duo and a tandem in the league right now, and where will they rank a year from now? And like, these two guys have worked so well together in all three zones, and it's just completely transformed this team. And I really do think, like, that could be considered a top three, top five tandem in the league as soon as next year. And that changes the outlook for Minnesota drastically moving forward. Right. And I think you really like what you've seen from them so far in this series. But if Minnesota wants to go further, it can't just be those guys. And I think that you would like to see a little bit more production from the rest of the lineup. But so far, they haven't needed it because those guys have been that good.
Yeah, it really makes it interesting because that's supposed to be one of the strengths of Vegas as well. They've got probably the best center, foursome probably in the Western Conference for sure, maybe even the league, but they just haven't been able to take advantage of that depth in this series thus far. Let's fast forward to tonight where you've got the LA Kings with a 2-0 lead heading to Edmonton against the Oilers. And with the Oilers, there's so much to talk about here. Cal Pickard, parachuting into this series, hoping that he can give him I don't think he needs to steal a game, but just give him a chance. But is this more about Matthias Ekholm? Because that defense looks out of sorts. It looks like it is absolutely wrecked. Evan Bouchard is not composed. Darnell Nurse is not providing what he's expected to. Is this a case for Matthias Ekholm being probably the third most important player on this team?
Ekholm's an interesting case. Like, I obviously think that they miss him, but he hasn't had the best year to begin with this year. The drop off from, like, some of the other defensemen that are still in the lineup is kind of surprising to me. I know Bouchard, you kind of just take the good with the bad there, but Darnell Nurse had been awesome for the Oilers basically this entire season and hasn't been so far in this series. Clearly, Jake Walman is a guy that they brought in hoping that he could be a difference maker. And I think you saw at points during the regular season, you're like, okay, wow, they might actually kind of have something here with Jake Walman. He's also been bad in this series, and it sounds weird to say, but it honestly seems like this team kind of misses Cody Ceci at this point, because Cody Ceci has looked pretty good for Dallas at points and is making a difference in that series against Colorado. Just as a whole, Ekholm or not, throughout the course of the season, you've just seen too many breakdowns defensively from Edmonton. And there's been so much conversation about Stuart Skinner and what he needs to be for this team. And now you go over to Pickard. I really don't think it matters a whole lot who's in net moving forward in this series, because if they play like they have in front of either one of those guys, this thing is over in four, because they just cannot defend. The breakdowns have just been an endless parade, and they're really not getting much outside of McDavid and Draisaitl in terms of their forward group. So that's just an absolute mess of a catastrophe carrying into this playoffs based off of the Edmonton Oilers team that you saw go to the Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final last year. It's just not the same team whatsoever.
Yeah, and it just feels that we're wild that we're kind of back at this point where we're talking and focusing so much on how flawed the roster is for Edmonton beyond McDavid and Draisaitl. And look, hey, we'll see where this series goes. You know, they're back at home. They've got a chance to turn things around here. But if they do have a quick first round exit the year after going to the Stanley Cup final, and you think of all the heat that Stan Bowman has taken for his offseason moves and losing guys like Holloway and Broberg and some of the other decisions he made, like, I think we're past, maybe we're not, but past the Will Connor McDavid leave conversation, especially if Draisaitl locked up long-term now. But he is eligible for an extension after this season. And I just wonder, like, what's the fallout going to be? If they're back to kind of falling flat on their face in the playoffs because the rest of the roster isn't up to snuff, it's difficult to see, like, what do you even do to reset things around McDavid and Draisaitl going forward?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And obviously, I'm sure there will be, like, very, very drastic reactions, especially after a quick exit. But I mean, like, I wouldn't panic a ton. Like, I still think this is a good team. It's obviously squandered opportunity that you haven't made. You haven't really crossed the finish line with McDavid and Draisaitl with so many years in their prime. But, I also think, like, there's been points during the season where this team has looked really good while healthy. And, a lot of things have clicked. But, you know, I think that the where they kind of failed was obviously in the offseason with the offer sheets. Like, failing to lock up those guys before they became available was stupid, and they'll regret that for sure. But you're talking about, like, maybe just a few pieces away from looking much better than they look right now. And I think you also have to give credit to L.A., for how they've looked in this series, because they're a much better team this year than they've been in the 4 years that you've seen this first round matchup. So the sky isn't falling. You obviously will be disappointed if you're an Oilers fan and this season ends with a whimper.
So looking at, you know, what we're doing here in Vancouver, obviously it's Rick Tocchet watch right now just to see if a contract is coming, or is this going to be maybe the breakup? But you're in Boston, you're a Boston guy. The Bruins are also looking for a head coach, and we were kind of doing a power rankings of the best situations in the NHL if you are Rick Tocchet or another coach. And I got to say, Boston was not in our top three. What's the sales pitch for Boston right now in terms of a high-profile coach?
I think that the sales pitch is probably like what remains of their core. Like, when you're talking about, they're not building from scratch in terms of a roster. You've got Charlie McAvoy, you have Hampus Lindholm on the back end. Like, those are two pretty strong pillars to build around. You've got a top three winger in the NHL and David Pastrnak, who is capable of driving a line, and you don't have to worry about honestly getting him elite players to play alongside to bring the best out of him, because he's proven he can do that no matter who's really next to him. Jeremy Swayman should be better, like, and you hope that he's better with that contract and the no move clause kicking in. But, like, you're right in the sense that it's not the most attractive job, and I think the part of that is because the farm system is pretty barren and you don't have a whole lot coming. But they're an original six franchise. They have, you know, money at their disposal. They're not going to be tied up against it with horrible, horrible contracts outside of the Elias Lindholm and Nikita Zadorov ones. But, like, there's it's not a completely blank canvas, but there's room to paint. And I think that that would be the sales pitch.
Pete, really appreciate the time. Enjoy the games tonight. Thanks for doing this.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That is Pete Blackburn. He hosts the What Chaos podcast covering the NHL. And interesting to hear even him say, you know, from Boston, yeah, it's not the most attractive job. I still look. It's like, hey, it's Pasta and it's McAvoy, Swayman. There are some things to work with there, but it's certainly lost a lot of luster over the last year.
You know what it reminded me of when he was describing Boston's current situation? It's like a Vancouver special. You know, the house, right?
Yep.
It's like, hey, it's
just needs a little love.
It needs a renovation. It's not quite, we're not tearing it down. It just needs some love. Maybe
the location's great.
The balcony still has a use, you know, that great structural design.
Yep.
It's got room.
Double doors, love that.
You know, Pastrnak can be like the big backyard. Swayman is the spacious kitchen. But it's seen better days.
Yeah, it needs some love, for sure. By the way, just on the point about Edmonton, looking to the future, and again, he's right. Look, you still have McDavid and Draisaitl. I don't, as much as people out here want to make it a thing, like, I don't think McDavid's going anywhere. I think he, with Draisaitl locked up, I think he's going to lock up as well. But one thing that stands out to me is beyond McDavid and Draisaitl, the forwards they have under contract for next year, starting from most salary to least: Zach Hyman, 32. Evander Kane, 33, was injured almost all of this year until the playoffs. Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, 32. Victor Arvidsson, 32. Adam Henrik, 35. Matthias Janmark, 32. Jeff Skinner's a UFA. He's 32. Feels like he probably won't be back. Corey Perry's playing on their top line. He's a UFA. He's 39. Connor Brown, UFA, 31. Then you have, you know, Vasily Podkolzin and some younger guys there. But, like, at the very bottom of your roster, all of their most important forwards who are under contract are either in their mid or, at the best, early 30s, going into their middle 30s. Like, you've got to make moves to drastically improve that team on the back end and in goal, but you also have to hope that you're able to retool your forward group, get younger, get faster in a hurry as well. Like, that's a daunting task ahead of them to remake that team this offseason pending the results of the playoffs.
Yeah, there were decisions that, you know, the Henrik contract you mentioned, they didn't have to sign that. Like, he was a UFA last summer. And they had to let, I guess, they made the decision to let Dylan Holloway go to St. Louis. And part of that was also Holloway did not get the playing time in Edmonton. So he signed that offer sheet. That was a very specific decision. Yep. And from what things that we've heard, it seemed like Darren Ferris is the one who pitched the idea for the offer sheet, which is very important detail here. The agent apparently went to St. Louis and said, let's make this happen.
Yeah.
That's fine. If that player is going elsewhere, you don't have to double down on aging veterans.
Nope.
And that's exactly what Edmonton did. And some of those guys, none of them worked out, really, if you think about it, right? Like, you talk about Henrique, Arvidsson hasn't worked out there. Their bets were for younger players like Vasily Podkolzin. Podkolzin, we know the story, tries hard, but sometimes just he can't deliver, mm-hmm. right? So where is that youth coming from? And sure, they have some players, a couple sprinkled in here and there in their youth system that might be able to give them a little bit, but you can't wait 2 or 3 years when you have Connor McDavid.
No.
Like, you need to win now. You need to win yesterday. So how does this team get any younger? How do they get more skilled? Like, if I'm the management there, sure, a lot of those contracts you didn't sign, but I don't think they helped themselves out last summer.
Oh, they sure didn't. I thought Pete brought up a great point as well. We're so focused on the absence of Matias Ekholm, which is totally fair, but he said, you know, it hasn't been his best season anyways.
Sure.
And Ekholm, 34 years old, 1 year left on his deal. And we're seeing how important he can be to this team. That's not a long-term situation. Do you want to commit again to him? How much longer is he going to be that super effective top pair defenseman as well? So, and there's no obvious, as we're seeing, there's no obvious replacement for Matias Ekholm.
And Jamie, this is why I had the Edmonton Oilers as my deadline loser. Because
yeah.
Sure, they pick up Wallman, but he's not the profile of defenseman that they needed. They needed somebody, and sure, this can be a indictment of Darnell Nurse, because he hasn't been able to provide, you know, over the last couple of years. This year, his regular season wasn't bad, but it wasn't $9.25 million good, right? Like, mm-hmm. It wasn't that good. You needed to reinforce on the defensive side of things. And for me, Wallman doesn't do that. I think he's more of an offensive-minded guy. He doesn't have that size. You needed somebody maybe in that 28-29 range that could actually give you solid defense. And
yep. What
is this team failing at right now? Clearing out.
It's defense.
Yeah, it's defense. Clearing out the blue paint, you know, boxing out, you know, making sure that they're taking the right angles. Like, they're missing on a defensive defenseman. So long term with Ekholm, absolutely. But you know what would have solved that? If you address that back end the right way at the deadline, you'd be a better team now. And potentially you might have a replacement for Ekholm. They're hurting both ways.
Just to dive back into the inbox with a couple of minutes left here in the show, and obviously over the weekend, we still haven't heard anything about Rick Tocchet. We'll see if we get a Friday news announcement, Friday afternoon news dump from some source or another here on Rick Tocchet, or if it drags through the weekend. But all eyes on Rick Tocchet's decision and the Canucks' decision as well. Keith the Water Guy texts in, do you think the holdup is only Tocchet's contract, or does it have to do with all the other assistants needing raises as well? That's an interesting point, that because I was wondering, well, what's the holdup? Get a deal done. Either there's a meeting of the minds or there isn't. Make a decision one way. Tocchet, we know, really tied to Adam Foote, of course. There was also the suggestion from him that maybe the part-time coach thing
yep. Doesn't
make sense. Maybe they have to look at something else. So you never know. Is there a situation where they're trying to figure out what the rest of the staff looks like? But if that's the holdup, you think, well, announce Tocchet. We'll figure that stuff out, right? You can do the handshake. Like, hey, let's get this done. We'll take care of your assistants, but let's do the announcement. I don't know if that's going to hold up a decision.
Yeah, that's usually a minor detail. But I will say Adam Foote, great job with the defense. Sure, he was helped out by bringing in new players. The other thing is the top 2-3 PK in the NHL this year, who runs it? Adam Foote. So, you know, it doesn't hold up deals, but you're talking about a coach that had made real progress. And every time we hear Quinn Hughes talk about Rick Tocchet, usually Adam Foote's name is mentioned shortly thereafter. So there is some cachet there, right? Like, it's not going to hold up a deal, but I certainly think it is a factor in terms of why the coaching staff has worked in Vancouver. Adam Foote's a big part of that.
Yeah. That is Canucks Talk for this week. Randeep, thank you for filling in. You'll be back on Monday as well. Reminder, decisive game 3 between Abbotsford and Tucson in the Calder Cup playoffs goes tomorrow at the Abbotsford Center, 7:00. Abby needs a win to keep their season alive and advance to the second round. The game will be on this station as well, so you can listen to it. Have a great weekend. We're back on Monday for more Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.